Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This week, rediscovering a lost abbey in the shadow of one of England's most iconic sites.
Time Team's Matt Williams on the work to learn more about a huge abandoned city.
And you'll get up to date with the latest archaeological discoveries in this month's Time Team News.
It's all on the Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. And we are on YouTube this week. So I will just say this, if you're watching us maybe for the first time and you don't know this already, we actually publish audio episodes every single Tuesday. So do make sure you find us wherever you get your podcasts. Now, I'll say it now as well. It's still not too late to watch all three episodes of our latest film, all about the village of Norton Disney in Lincolnshire. Really, really interesting. And I know that there are plenty of eagle-eyed Time Team fans who spotted all of the Easter eggs in the graphics towards the end of the third episode. Helen, I don't know whether you've seen these yet. Well done if that was you. I was looking for ages and I struggled to see them. So well done if you managed to do that. Now, Helen, I am very jealous of you, I have to say, at the moment because, well, you were... gallivanting. You were on the razzle last night, weren't you?
Yes, everybody's very jealous of me. As I was leaving the British Museum to go to Tony's book launch party, they said, oh, we wish we were coming with you. And this is what I got. There, look.
Hey, wow, look at that. So hold on, because I've got one that was sent to me the other day and it's blue. Yours is red. So why is yours red?
Mine, because I was lucky enough to go to the launch, you could buy a first edition. And the first edition is much more splendiferous. I mean, it's got the same design, but it's got those lovely edges of the paper that there, as you can see there, which is just so eye-catching and so lovely. Now, I don't know. I know that there are only 1,000 in the first edition. I don't know how many were snapped up by us last night. I don't know whether there'll be any left to buy. But I am pretty exhausted this morning because it went on quite late and there were a lot of very fun people there, lots of old friends. I didn't get home until gone 1 in the morning. So it was great fun.
Yes, and it was very well attended. Lots of famous faces there. And I know that Tony Robinson was speaking outside of the bookshop in London where this took place.
Yes, do you know, it was in Covent Garden in a bookshop that was several little rooms. You know, there was a glass of wine in one room and you could leave your coat in another room. But we were basically packed into these little rooms. So because it was in Covent Garden with the nice little kind of pedestrian streets, we all went outside for Tony to give a speech and thank everybody and so on, because it was the only place where everybody could hear him. So there were a lot of passers-by who were completely kind of gobsmacked to see all these celebs, you know, like Rowan Atkinson, out in the middle of the road listening to somebody.
20 years ago, I began working with this incredibly dedicated team of historians and archaeologists who had the most incredible rigour and respect and passion about archaeology. It's lovely to see Professor Martin Carver here tonight. And they were an enormous influence. I mean, 20 years I spent with them. And for 10 years I worked with another group of incredibly bright and intelligent young men, all of whom loved history and all of whom used it cynically in order to use whatever they wanted to make funny jokes, out of which Time Team was born. And by the way, Blackadder. And it was, I think, the combination of those two disciplines that has really so influenced the book. And I think if you'll read it, you'll be able to see that there.
It's so lovely, isn't it, to hear Tony speak so fondly, as he always does, about Time Team. But great to hear that Time Team and Blackadder sort of played a part in his writing.
Yes, and there was such a mix of people there yesterday that they were people who had shaped Tony's thinking. I mean, obviously, you know, Mick was the big person who was missed and who the book's dedicated to Tony's lovely wife Louise and to Mick. To see how Blackadder had also made him begin to think about history, and then it had all of the historians and archaeologists and so on who'd helped to not just to fact check, but also to kind of give some underpinnings. So the bits that I read on the train home last night are just really solid. Sometimes in a historical novel, you feel that you've got a bit of anachronism or whatever, but I felt I was in really good hands here. It was really reassuring, because there are lots of people who know an awful lot about the 9th century and about Alfred the Great and about just the tenor of the times that have pointed him in the right direction.
So it really is grounded in history and archaeology, which is fantastic. I can't wait to read it. My copy only arrived yesterday, so I'm really looking forward to getting my teeth into it. Shall we get going then on the podcast? Because I want to talk to you about this. This autumn, Time Team is actually bringing you a really special program. We're so excited about it. Unearthing the mystery of a lost medieval abbey.
Cern Abbas, home of the famously enigmatic, baton-wielding and very nude giant. But beneath his feet lie the remains of a lost Benedictine abbey.
Hugh, there's stuff absolutely everywhere in this trench. What a feast for the eyes.
We're not just interested in the central part of the monastery, we're interested in the whole landscape around us, because, you know, all these features are interconnected.
We knew that the abbey was somewhere. It's in the name.
Well, would you have a look at that?
It's huge.
It is huge.
That is so sharp. I tell you what, I wish that was our data set.
And that's so vibrant, isn't it? The lovely mould decoration and the paint.
So here we have the archaeology of the dissolution of the monasteries right here in front of our eyes.
It's the closest we've got so far to actually the people who were here in the church. We've learnt things we didn't know before, and it's really confirmed some of our hypotheses.
And has ever raised a few more questions, I guess.
Certainly has.
Lots of questions there, and we're hoping to bring you some answers. Now, could there be a link between the Christian abbey there and that very pagan-looking giant on the hillside just 500 metres away? Now, it seems quite impossible in a way, doesn't it? But Time Team's been following the story as archaeologists from the Cern Abbey Research Project grapple with the very surprising facts, and those, you can't argue with the facts. The twists and turns in this story are extraordinary. Here on the podcast, we wanted to bring you even more ahead of the video's release. So let's head over to site and join Time Team's Lawrence Shaw. Lawrence!
Thank you very much, guys. I'm here at Cern Abbas in Dorset, and more specifically, we're back at Cern Abbey with Hugh Wilmot. Hugh, how are you, all right?
Very well, Lawrence.
Good.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. And this trench is looking bigger and more exciting every time we come back. Has it been a good season so far?
It has. It's been a bit tough at times. Weather's been very hot, a bit wet, but we've got some great archaeology.
Excellent. So this is your third year of excavations, with a year before that of geophysical surveys. We have a Time Team episode coming out from the last 2 years at least, which is going to cover some of your discoveries. What can people expect to find out?
Well, they're going to find out lots about the Abbey of CERN, which, you know, we didn't know very much about archaeologically. So we've been excavating the later medieval phases of the site, but also we've been trying to find the earlier history. And that's probably some of the most exciting stuff.
That is exciting. So we have things like tile floors, we have walls, we have beautiful masonry, we have comparisons to other sites in the region and a time period. There's some deep questions about earliest possible time period linked to this site, and some bigger monuments that maybe just on the hill up there as well.
Maybe, yes.
So it's a fantastic programme, and I think we're all looking forward to seeing it. What about this year? What sort of hints? I guess we haven't covered it as much in terms of the episode that's coming out. So what things have you been revealing this year?
Well, we've been getting more walls and floors from the later monastery. So we've got some nice in situ floor material, decorated tiles.
Is there some around here?
Yes, we've got a little bit over here still in place.
Oh, look at that. That's beautiful.
So I'm actually stood on a medieval floor that's lower than that. But up here, you can see the tiles still in place. I mean, they've had a hard life. They've been crushed. They're very worn. They've been walked on for a couple of hundred years and come quite broken. But that is an in situ section of floor. And that matches some of the things we found previously as well. So that's nice extra sort of detail there as well.
Lovely. Right. Well, I'll leave you to it for now. Martin, I'm going to go and meet a few other people and find out what I can learn.
Sounds like a good idea. Thank you very much, Lawrence. We'll catch up with you a little bit later on.
We have one of the stars of the CERN Abbas film with us now from another excavation. It's Time Team's Matt Williams here. Matt, where are you?
Well, hi, Helen. Well, I'm some distance from CERN Abbas now. I'm up in Shropshire at Attingham Park, which is the National Trust estate. And as you can see, we're not actually next to the big fancy house. We're in the middle of a field here.
Oh, that is so cool. Well, look, we need to talk a little bit more about what you're doing there in just a moment. But first, I do want to talk about CERN Abbas. Without giving anything away, Matt, I know you've got to keep things quite tight-lipped. What surprised you most, though, about that CERN Abbas dig?
Well, I think the thing that surprised me most was what also surprised Hugh when he was looking for the site, which was what an amazing site it was and how well preserved it was and how many kind of walls and features and how much architectural remains there were in a field that nobody knew, or nobody thought there was anything there, or nobody knew the abbey was there. So how all this huge archaeological site, a very robust archaeological site, had managed to remain hidden in a blank field until they came along and uncovered it. It was absolutely amazing and really surprising.
So did they know the precise location? Was it actually known about before? So it was a completely new discovery.
Well, they knew that the abbey was around there. Hugh had ideas because of the earthworks, but they didn't actually know the exact location of all the buildings.
It's so, so exciting. And not just because of the archaeology that you found, but because of the location that you were in as well. That site and the chalk giant on the hillside is known the world over. What did it feel like to be digging in such an iconic location?
It was really exciting to go down there for various reasons. One, the giant is so enigmatic and so strange. It's very rude. It's not the kind of thing you'd associate with a medieval abbey at all. So why were they next to each other? And it was untangling that, things we could kind of untangle that and get any closer to the relationship between this really, quite frankly, bizarre chalk image and what could be seen as a more kind of traditional, very religious religious building right at the base of it.
Matt, do you know why they gave him such a big willy?
I don't know why they gave him such a big willy, but I can tell you that it was actually smaller, I believe. Over the years, of course, all archaeological features, all or historic monuments, they get altered. The Victorians and the antiquarians are always messing around with stuff. Its present form is not exactly as they think it was when it was very first made. That's all I'm going to say.
But But it's extraordinary that it survived the Victorians, isn't it, when you think how dedicated they were to covering up stuff like that.
Exactly, yeah. You would have thought they'd have put a nice pair of trousers on it, maybe. Yes. The shirt and the tie, a little bow tie or something. But it's incredible what they have done to it. They can date the exposure to the sun in, using the quartz crystals, all this kind of stuff. So it's amazing that they had anything left to work with, really.
Yes, it is. It is absolutely extraordinary. And talking of extraordinary sites, what are you doing at Attingham?
Well, I did mention that on a National Trust site, you might expect to see a large 18th, 19th century building. I'm just in a field here. Behind me, you might just be able to see a fence line and a few trees. On the other side of that is a Roman city, Roxeter Roman City. It's completely buried. It's a scheduled monument, and I'm just sitting outside it here. So what we're doing here is examining some of the small features in the fields outside the Roman city. There was a large geophysics survey done here last year, one of the biggest geophysical surveys ever carried out in the UK. There are pits and ditches, a couple of trackways, one of which goes underneath the Roman defences behind me, so it predates the Roman city wall and bank and ditch behind me. The geophysics, I might add, was incredible. Amazing results. Is that reflected in what we're digging up here?
So you're almost doing a classic Time Team three-dayer, aren't you? And that Mick always used to say that our ambitions were condition, date and extent. What is it? How big is it? And what condition is it in terms of how we should manage it going onwards?
You mentioned the extent of this big, big Roman city that you are just a few hundred metres away from at the moment. So put the area you're in context. How important would it have been during the Roman period?
It was very important because the land that I'm on at the moment is some of the most fertile land in the country, certainly the most fertile land in Shropshire. So it would have been very highly prized. There's a huge, I don't know if you can see, over there, the kind of hill with the antenna on, that's the Wrekin. It is a huge Iron Age hill fort. Every single hill around here has got some kind of Iron Age hill fort enclosure on it. It was very well defended. Everyone wanted to live here. People were always chasing those people off. When the Romans got here, they built Roxeter. What's the word? They established Roxeter, probably on an already existing Iron Age settlement of some sort. There was probably a lot going on here already.
Roxeter is not a current settlement, is it? So what happened to this huge Roman city that means that people aren't living there now?
Well, that's a great question, Martin, and one that many archaeologists have pondered for a long time. So some Roman cities, like London being the classic example, are now large urban settlements. Whether they remained continuously settled, we're still working on. Here, abandoned, Silchester, a great example of a really important and large Roman town or city, which was completely abandoned. You've just got the walls now and nothing inside. Quite why that happened, I don't know. Certainly, the economy changed and the way people liked to live changed as well. Quite why it was abandoned, I'm not sure. Helen, with your Anglo-Saxon knowledge, do you have any idea as to why the kind of early medieval settlers or the early medieval population decided to stay away from these places?
Well, it's one of the big questions, isn't it? Because those examples of completely abandoned Roman towns, that you find them in every bit of England. So we've got Roxeter, we've got Silchester, but we've also got Venter Iconorum, Caister by Norwich, which is the centre of the East Anglian, what became East Anglia, quite close to Norwich, but not that close. So it's not, well, you didn't have enough Anglo-Saxons over in Roxeter to make it worthwhile keeping the town on or whatever. You could organise your questions in this kind of, well, that bit stayed more Roman, that bit became more Anglo-Saxon, maybe that's why there's a difference. But there isn't a difference. Are we looking at patterns or are we looking at something that's specific for each town? It is really, really difficult to say, but you have to also remember that in the more Anglo-Saxon areas, there would be a break quite early on when towns were not livable in. And it's been suggested for London that the sea level rose and that made the port of London actually unusable. And that's why London Wick, the Anglo-Saxon London, had to move a little way away. So there might be specific reasons for each place, or it might be that there's a break at different times. So Wroxeter might have staggered on for a bit longer. At some point, there would have been a break, and just nobody ever came back to Wroxeter. Whereas at Winchester, they did come back to Winchester, for example. So, and you never quite know whether that's one person saying, hey, let's go and occupy this place. You know, maybe it's seen as being something that is easy to fortify. There can be so many individual reasons that each one needs looking at really thoroughly. But actually, there must be a Roman towns expert who has a view on this. Perhaps we ought to try to find them.
We could probably hypothesise on why Wroxeter became abandoned until the cows come home. But Matt, I know you've got a lot of work to do there where you are at the moment. What's the eventual plan with this then? What will success look like?
A big question of this is, does the geophysics work? And is it reflecting in the ground? Is the ground excavation reflecting what we've got in our geophysics? That's a really big question, because if we can understand that, we can extrapolate that across the whole area of geophysics.
Matt, thank you very much. Best of luck with it. And do try and stay out of the rain best you can.
Yeah, good luck. Hope it goes well.
Thank you very much. Lovely to speak to you. And I'll see you soon.
It's been another busy month for archaeology. And Martin, you've been having a look this month at some of the Time Team news.
I have, yes. And first, I want to take you to Guardbridge, a tiny village near St Andrews in Fife in Scotland. Archaeologists have discovered evidence the village has been occupied for over 12,000 years. Tools used for weaving woolen cloth and moulds for making a sword blade that dated to the Bronze Age were discovered. Earlier than that, Neolithic pits containing burnt cereal grains were found. But the finds actually get even older than that. Radiocarbon dating of a fire pit dated it to somewhere between 4320 and 4051 BC. Researchers also found flints from as early as the late Upper Paleolithic period, that is around 10,000 BC. So what was life like then for the people who lived in Guardbridge all those years ago? Well, traces of a campsite used by hunter-gatherers suggest a temporary shelter, and those burnt grains in the pits give us clues as to what they might have eaten. What's really interesting here, though, is the scale and the range of the finds, with the director of the excavation saying she didn't expect to find the whole prehistory of Fife in one field. Next to the bloody gladiator battles in Roman amphitheatres. Crowds would gather to watch the violent clashes between men, many of them slaves condemned to die in the arenas, and often live animals. Now, it had long been thought that bears, specifically brown bears, were used in the fighting, but until now, evidence of their capture and use in amphitheatres across the empire has been quite hard to come by. Researchers in Serbia have discovered the skull of one such animal in a building next to an arena in the ancient Roman city of Viminacium. Using DNA analysis, they were able to find out loads about it. The bear was a 6-year-old male, and comparison to modern brown bears suggests that it was local to the area, meaning that it was captured in the Balkans for the purpose of bringing it to do battle against gladiators. The animal's skull was fractured, and further analysis points to an injury caused by the blunt strike of a weapon. That, though, is not how the bear died. That's thought to have come about as the result of a secondary infection. One more thing to note here, which sheds light on the condition that these fighting bears were kept in. The bear's teeth showed patterns of wear consistent with constant grinding and rubbing against the metal or wooden bars of a cage. Finally, let me take you to the Birmingham of Italy. Venice is known for its canals, its incredible architecture, and iconic monuments, one of which is the city's famous winged lion. For hundreds of years, It sat proudly on its column in St. Mark's Square. But the story of how it came to be has often baffled historians. Archaeologists now think they've worked it out. By doing analysis of its metal content, they've discovered it must have been produced in China and brought back to the city, perhaps by Marco Polo's father and uncle after their first expedition to the court of the Mongol Khan. Its age is also something of a mystery. Texts suggest it must be far older than the column on which it stands. Well, further examination shows the lion's shape was altered at some point to remove horns. With the horns reinstated, it would have resembled stone lions set up to guard graves in the Tang Dynasty that ruled China from the 7th to 10th centuries. Could it be then that the lion which now guards St. Mark's Square once guarded with horns and longer ears a Tang Dynasty tomb? Well, that's it for Time Team News for this month. We'll keep telling you about the archaeological discoveries from around the world here on the Time Team podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geet, where earlier on you heard from Time Team's Lawrence Shaw. Now, he's on site at Cerne Abbas in Dorset, famous for that huge chalk giant that's etched into the hillside overlooking the village below. And Time Team have been following a dig there to discover more about a lost abbey. So let's return to Lawrence to see who else he's talking to.
It has been great to be back here at Cerne Abbey to see all their new trenches, their new discoveries. And it's been a real treat to have Will here, who's been doing blacksmithing and metalworking. And metalworking is something that was part of last year's discoveries, and Helen was involved with that. Helen, how are you?
I'm very well.
Good. Have you been involved with the excavations this year?
I have. I've been able to do a little bit in this trench here. And it's just fantastic to be back and see how much they've achieved.
The weather's beautiful. Yes. I think it was very wet last year.
Some great
stuff. But with regards to the program that's coming out, you have been very involved with the dig the last few years. It's so nice to have the metalworking sort of reconstructions here, because you were involved with a metalworking discovery last year.
Yeah, back in the trench behind us, we found a really interesting metalworking feature, which is very unusual, very special to have here. It's great to be having this right next to a metalworker working on stuff that we found from the site.
Yeah, it's a real treat. But also, as well as that, you've also been looking at that larger landscape narrative and perhaps a bit of deep time.
Yeah. Right above our heads, you know, is the giant. So we have this extraordinary new date for the giant that's been revealed, and I've been trying to understand then how do we understand why there is an early medieval giant here in Cerne. And so that's what I've really been thinking about, as new theories to try to place that within its social and cultural context. And then to tie it up here with the excavations, that's telling us so much more about understanding the context in which he was created.
It is an absolutely fascinating bit of research, and people will be able to hear more about this on the episode when it comes out very, very soon. But for now, I'll hand back to you, Martin and Helen, in the studio.
In the studio? We don't have a studio. But thank you very much, Lawrence. It's great to hear some of that very tantalising detail. Now, Martin, I think it's fair to say that the one date that everybody thought was absolutely impossible for the giant was early medieval. I mean, Iron Age has been suggested, Roman, medieval, even 17th century, but not early medieval. I mean, that date completely came out of the blue. But I am really glad to see Helen Gittos taking that problem and running with it, because she's both an archaeologist and a historian. We know her from her work on Sutton Hoo. She's incredibly well informed, and she's got this ability to kind of see the bigger picture and not let go of it until she's got a story that works. So I'm really intrigued to see what she's going to come up with.
Yeah, and we've had Helen Gittos actually on this podcast before. Just a really, really interesting person. I think we need to get her back on, don't we? Maybe after those CERN Abbas videos have gone up on YouTube, and we can maybe talk a little bit more about it. Right, questions now, I think, if you're ready for these, Helen. So these are questions that Time Team members have been submitting on Patreon. There's a little section where you can go and ask your question to Helen for a future episode. And this one has come in from Germany.
Hi, Helen. Hi, Martin. Hi to everyone at Time Team and to everyone listening to this. My name is Giza. I am from North Germany, from Hamburg specifically. And I was wondering how extensive cooperation between countries is when it comes to archaeology. For example, here in North Germany is where the Anglo-Saxons are from. So how does something that is found in one country relate to something that is found in the other country? And does it help with the understanding of this culture and of this time period?
That's another really good question. I mean, ideally, there would be lots and lots of collaboration between projects in different countries. So if you're doing a research project that involves, say, pilgrim badges that can move over country boundaries, or Anglo-Saxon house types that are developed from prototypes elsewhere, or something like the start of agriculture in the Neolithic that spreads all over the place, anything that might have an international dimension, it is really sensible to find out who else is working on this kind of thing in those relevant countries. But it usually works on personal contacts rather than anything more formal. And so that's why it's so important to go to things like international conferences and so on, to find out all that gossip, who's working on what, who's interested in what, spreading the word about what you want to find out about, seeing who might be open to a collaboration and so on. But those conferences are expensive and they're time consuming. It's not easy, but it's something that we've always got to keep in our minds. A collaboration is always better than working on your own.
Yeah, and the benefits, I guess, are pretty obvious. I mean, we were talking a little while ago with a researcher, weren't we, in the Netherlands, who was doing some work on the limes of the Roman Empire, the frontier of the Roman Empire, and work that she'd been doing on encampments, Roman encampments that had been found north of that. And when we were talking to her, you were saying, oh goodness, you know, there's parallels here with some of the things that we found north of Hadrian's Wall and around that sort of area. And that maybe could inform work that's going on in other parts of the world.
Yes, and if you just take my area of expertise, which is artifacts, we've known for a couple of hundred years that what you find in what you could call late Iron Age northern Germany and that area around about, so kind of southern Denmark and the northern Netherlands and so on, it's really similar, that material culture, to that of the earliest Anglo-Saxon sites in England. So you get the same large cremation cemeteries, and they've got the same types of pottery vessels and the same types of grave goods. We're looking for subtle differences in design and in date, and in fact we've shown from those that the Anglo-Saxon objects here are more made to look like the German objects. There's not so many imports. They're not doing slavish copies. They're doing something different. And you wouldn't really know that without looking at the full European kind of panoply. As always, the British are one of the worst nations at working internationally. We do tend to be a little bit insular. You have to resist the temptation to just keep your focus narrow.
Okay, final question now, and it comes from Derek, who is talking about an object with a real link to Norton Disney, which is, of course, what our previous set of Time Team episodes have been about. Derek says, is archaeology any closer to solving the mystery of the Roman dodecahedron? Ah, yes, so this is a very tantalising object. It's not the only one, by the way, the one that was found at Norton Disney, but certainly the Norton Disney one is one of the most famous. Helen, can you just explain a little more about this particular object? What is the Roman dodecahedron that everyone's got so excited about?
A dodecahedron has 12 sides, which is what the word means. And there are these hollow dodecahedrons that are occasionally found in Roman contexts. I think we've got about 14 of them or fragments of them on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database. And I think that includes the Norton Disney one. So if you go to the Portable Antiquities Scheme database and type in dodecahedron, you won't find very many objects that have got that word in it. So you should find one to look at. I think there's maybe 60 or so from across the whole of the Roman Empire. Although I'm no expert on them, I do know a few things. So as I said, hollow. The 12 faces are pentagonal, and at the corners of these pentagons that make up each of the sides, they have kind of round balls, big blobs, so that when you put it on something like a table, it doesn't stand on one of its flat faces. It stands on these bald kind of feet. And then in the centre of each of the pentagonal faces, there's a circle, a hole that goes through to the middle. And each of these holes is of different sizes. What it resembles more than anything else is one of those toys that you give to toddlers where you have different shaped holes and you can push different shapes through the holes, and it's satisfying and teaches them hand-eye coordination and which shape is which. There are a lot of suggestions that I think it's always worth making a suggestion that you then might be able to test or to run with and see whether you can think of any other supporting information. So the two that I've heard recently are that they are nutmeg graders and they are ornaments. Now, both of those are interesting things. Let's take nutmeg graders first. The idea comes from nutmegs being, as a spice, very precious and expensive and so on. Because the holes are all different sizes, you can use your dodecahedron to measure the size of your nutmeg. Although once you've pushed it in, I don't know how easy it'd be to get it out again. So I feel like we're on call my bluff here. I'm going to give you several ideas and you can see what they're like. But so, nutmeg grader, it's for grading nutmegs. How would you test this? If it was pottery that had been used for cooking something with nutmeg in, maybe some kind of oil or wax from the nutmeg might be absorbed by the pottery and you could do a lipid analysis. But on copper alloy, which all of these are made of, I can't see that there's going to be any residue. There's no wear on the holes to suggest that endless nutmegs have been pushed through. So I feel that one needs to be discarded because at the moment there's no evidence for it.
I don't like that one either because it seems overly complicated for that function. Why does it have the little balls on it? Why on earth would you make something where you have to push the nutmeg in and then you obviously would struggle to get it back out when you could just have like a plate that you could have holes in? I don't buy it.
No, I don't like that one. And particularly, I don't like it because it doesn't seem testable. The next one sounds bad to begin with, ornament, but actually it's been suggested by a team who are working on maths in the past. They're looking at architecture and at crystals, jewellery, that kind of thing, to see if they can see an interest in pure maths and geometry, not in the classical world, but in the world of Britain. And they've said, well, shouldn't we be analysing the maths behind this? And not necessarily as a useful thing, but because it looks so much like something that you might kind of put on your desk as almost like an executive toy or an ornament that just showed how you were up with the modern mathematical thinking. So it's a bit of intellectual advertisement. Now, I quite like that because I can see how it could be tested. And I want somebody who knows about geometry to have more of a look at these dodecahedrons so you can compare them all. And you can see whether they embody fundamental mathematical concepts. So that's the one that I'm going with at the moment.
Well, it's certainly more likely than the nutmeg one. I think the nutmeg one is, quite frankly, a bit silly. But I think that one does seem to be a little bit better. It's definitely got me thinking, though. So thank you very much for that, Derek. That is fantastic question. And please do, if you're watching this on YouTube and you've got a theory of your own for what these dodecahedrons might have been used for, pop it in the comments and we'd love to read your thoughts. If you're a Time Team member, that is how you can ask your question. There's a special section over on the community chats area. You just pop your question in there and you can get it answered.
That's about it for the Time Team podcast for this week. If you've been watching this episode on YouTube, then don't forget that we have an audio episode every week. So don't forget to find us where you normally get your podcasts. So that's every Tuesday, a brand new episode.
Next week, it is all about your questions. Helen's going to be considering all sorts of things, loads of thoughts from Time Team members. Head to Patreon, as I mentioned, you can ask your question right now, and we will catch you on the next edition of the Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.